This is KFSK's Midday Magazine for Thursday, September 22nd. I'm Angela Denning. The moose hunt near Petersburg Wrangell and Cake has finished up its first week, and hunters have reported taking 23 bulls in the area. Hunters have 5 days to check in a harvested moose, so that number could increase slightly. 23 moose in the first week is considered average, according to Rich Lowell, the area wildlife biologist. The harvest is down from last year when hunters took 34 moose in the first week. But last year was the second highest harvest on record. According to Lowell, last year's harvest was fueled by a strong early season showing from the Stikine River, which contributed to a high season total of 106 moose. The local moose hunt has antler restrictions, and Lowell says 2 of the 23 moose taken so far this year are not legal. That's about 8% of the harvest, significantly less than last year. Of the 34 moose taken in the first week last year, 7 were illegal, or 20% of the harvest. In 2009, moose antler restrictions were liberalized to allow the harvest of bulls with 2 brow tines on both antlers. Since then, the annual harvest has ranged from 68 to 109 moose, averaging 92 per year. The average harvest during the first week is 24 bulls. Lowell says in general, most bulls are killed during the first half of the season, and the success rate typically declines as the season progresses. Here is the breakdown of where the moose were harvested in week 1. Kuprinoff Island had 6 bulls taken, Stikine River 5, Thomas Bay 4, Mitkoff Island 4, Farragut Bay 2, Wrangell Island 1, and Virginia Lake 1. And you can also see those numbers on our website, kfsk.org. Searchers continued looking yesterday for a Sitka man last seen Monday on the Mount Verstovia Trail. Alaska State Troopers spokeswoman Megan Peters says hikers saw 37-year-old Michael Hansen on his way up the steep trail a few miles from town.
We do know that he's not well-dressed to spend a substantial amount of time in the outdoors, wearing street clothes essentially and having a backpack with them. But when you're outside for longer than your planned quick day hike, things can always get a bit hairy, especially when it gets cooler at nighttime.
The National Weather Service predicted strong winds and heavy rain as a major storm moves in today. Temperatures were expected to be in the 50s or the upper 40s. Hansen is described as 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighing about 180 pounds, with a short, military-style haircut. He has brown hair and brown eyes. Officials say he's only been in town since July. Peter says troopers are working with the Sitka Search and Rescue, search dogs from Sitka and Juneau, and the U.S. Coast Guard.
We do have ground searchers out again today going and looking in the area as best as they can. The United States Coast Guard has supplied a helicopter to help ferry searchers going back and forth. And they're also flying over the area to try and keep an eye out, and hopefully they'll be able to find him.
She says searchers would decide what to do next after comparing notes following yesterday's search. Anyone with relevant information is asked to call the troopers, Sitka Search and Rescue, or the Sitka Fire Department. Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott said the state needs to deal with the reality of climate change and is committed to keeping rivers flowing into southeast Alaska unpolluted from mining projects across the border. Mallott gave the keynote address yesterday to the annual meeting of Southeast Conference in Petersburg. The regional group of municipalities and businesses focuses on economic development, transportation, and industry in Southeast Alaska. Mallott told the gathering about attending an oceans conference hosted by Secretary of State John Kerry in Washington, D.C. this month. He said he was struck by how Alaska looms large in the worldview of climate change, and he related a message told to him by his son, a commercial fisherman who longlines and power trolls in the Gulf of Alaska.
He said to me last winter, he said, "I'm beginning to lose my internal compass as I fish. Things are changing. Water temperature's changing. Weather patterns are changing. The timing of fish runs are changing. It's obvious, but I can't see it, that what I have come to know is no longer serving me in ways that it should." I think we all feel that as we're out in the natural world.
The Lieutenant Governor highlighted the importance of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, and the money those organizations can bring to the climate change problem. Malott also told the group about work to finalize a statement of cooperation between Alaska and British Columbia on mining projects near the Taku, Stikine, and Yunik rivers that flow into southeast Alaska. Residents on this side of the border are concerned about mine pollution in the rivers and the impact that could have on important fisheries. The Lieutenant Governor traveled to Vancouver this month with a representative from the Tlingit and Haida Central Council to meet with representatives of the BC government and First Nations. Malott told the Southeast Conference of the state's commitment to address the issue.
We are completely with the people of Southeast Alaska on this quest to make sure that those transboundary rivers remain as pristine, as environmentally intact and productive as they have been and are now far into Alaska's future.
Malott says a statement of cooperation is in its third draft and he hopes to have it signed by the end of this month or early next month. That statement could lay out a framework for Alaska's input on mine permitting by the provincial government. Alaska's congressional delegation sent a second letter September 9th to Secretary of State Kerry asking for State Department involvement with Canada on the issue. Malott said he planned to sign that letter but was traveling and was unable to do so in time. In other topics, Malott noted the failure of pink salmon returns around Alaska. He reported that Alaska has issued two disaster declarations for failure of runs in Kodiak and Prince William Sound, and requests have come in from other parts of Alaska. Malott said the state has requested federal disaster declarations for at least Kodiak and Prince William Sound. He also highlighted the decision by Governor Walker to put on hold cost-cutting measures to restructure the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Malott explained that the state wanted to involve stakeholders in the process and hear from people impacted.
When government is not listening, when government is not engaging, leaning into the wind of the voice of the public, small people suffer. People with power will find a way to have access and to be heard. But so many who live their lives every single day believing in the goodness in government and in the impact of governmental policy overall on their lives, when they begin to question that, my friends, democracy is in trouble.
Malott concluded his speech with the belief that the state legislature would address Alaska's budget crisis this session. You can listen to Malott's entire keynote address on our website, kfsk.org, and we will be hearing more from Malott coming up tomorrow on Local News. The Alaska Recreation and Park Association honored a Petersburg resident, a local park project, and a local organization at the end of the group's annual conference in Petersburg last Friday. The statewide organization of recreation professionals gave a Facility Excellence Award for Outlook Park on Sandy Beach Road. Sally Dwyer was presented with the Distinguished Service Award, and the Petersburg Chamber of Commerce was recognized with an Outstanding Organization Award. Former Petersburg Parks and Rec Director Donnie Hayes organized the conference in Petersburg, and Joe Vicknicki spoke with him about those three honors.
Well, you know, honestly, they were, in my opinion, awards that should have been a long time coming, without a doubt. The Outlook Park was chosen as a Facility of Excellence by the Alaska Recreation and Parks Association. Between the community support, the fact that we took an old pump house and turned it into a shelter, and also, you know, made the change from it being the old dump to the beauty that it is right now, really has become a gem of the community, and I think something that everybody really truly appreciates, and the hard work that Jesse put into the layout, the design, and also the actual construction of it, and the fact that you know, we had community members donating to it. Public Works was had a heavy hand in it. There were a lot of community support for that project, and so the fact that it was named, you know, or awarded that title, I think is very deserving.
Chamber of Commerce got an award as well?
Yeah, and so their award was given to a community nonprofit or business that continually supported recreation in their community. And when if you live in Petersburg, even for a few moments, you quickly realize that the Chamber of Commerce supports recreation and excels in creating recreational opportunities, whether it be, you know, their support of the 4th of July, the managing of the Little Norway Festival, the fishing derby, the tree lighting ceremony, you name it, they are typically right there and involved. And so the businesses are a very, very important part of what we do as far as recreation in the community of Petersburg. And they are all right there as members of the Chamber of Commerce. I know that Petersburg Parks and Recreation couldn't do it without their support, you know, time and time again. The last award that was given, at least to Petersburg, was actually given to Sally Dwyer. And so that one, you just look at the years and years of support that she has given to recreation. She was one of the people that spearheaded the raising of funds for Outlook Park. You look back in history, and she has been critical in helping with you know, art installations. You name it, you know, Sally has truly been a part of this community time and time again. And so I was really, really pleased to see that the Alaska Recreation and Parks Association noticed and was willing to you know, present that award to her.
You've been a board member of that group, I think, and helped organize this whole conference that you just got done with.
Yeah, for the last 2 years I've been working on this conference. It was absolutely wonderful. The members that attended from all over the state, Parks and Rec directors, program coordinators, lots of vendors that came as well, they all walked away saying, man, this is one of the best conferences that we've had in years. And they were really, really pleased. There are times when people are a little bit concerned about coming to a smaller community in the state like Petersburg, but as usual, we knock their socks off. And that's to be expected from the people here in Petersburg, honestly.
About 50 people were in town for that conference, and those awards were given out during a closing banquet Friday night. An unusual foe is frustrating Haines fishermen in the last few weeks of the season. A rust-colored algae bloom floating in the Lynn Canal is clinging to gillnets and turning off fish that would otherwise be caught. KHNS's Abby Collins reports from Haines.
I'm disgruntled. I'm going to pull my net off and quit.
That's Bill Thomas. He's been fishing for 47 years, and he says this year the algae is the worst he's ever seen. He's at the Haines Harbor washing the remainder of the brownish-red slime off the net on the FV Ravens Walk.
This is the worst ever. I mean, we had the power washer on the net back here. You can see that little bar there, and it sprays water out there, and it was just solid rust color down below.
Fishermen often deal with algae, but Thomas says it's not usually as widespread as he's seen in recent weeks.
We'd see little blossoms or little blooms of them around, but not the whole bay from here down, from what I understand, to Mab Island.
Ryan Cook is the president of the Lynn Canal Gillnetters Association. He says the bloom has been around the canal for 3 or 4 weeks now.
Some of it's brown, some of the stuff I had the other day was orange and just slimy.
He says the algae sticks to fishermen's nets, making it look like a wall.
And the fish just see this big wall in front of it and they go around it.
The algae is a nuisance, but it shouldn't have a major impact on the fishery overall. Cook expects to be gillnetting for another few weeks.
I definitely have another opening.
Mark Soggy is the Haines Area Management Biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Next week we'll determine what I do the following week, and that and the fact that if people want to keep fishing, if the processor want to keep buying, and if the fish are available.
Soggy says dealing with algae is nothing new for fishermen.
It's not usually as much of a problem as it's been this year. It's not like it doesn't occur sometimes, but it seems consistently thick all the way from Mab Island all the way up to in front of town up here. So that does cut down their efficiency for sure.
Still, Soggy is not really concerned about the number of fish being caught.
That would occur if we end up with a situation where we're overscaping the system. So we couldn't, in other words, couldn't harvest the fish because the fish were, say, for instance, going underneath this algae and deeper than the nets were, and then we were overscaping. That hasn't occurred.
Soggy says escapement for fall chum is around average right now and is projected to be about 200,000 fish. But for fishermen like Thomas, it's just not worth continuing the season for the amount of fish he's bringing in. He says in one day, he caught 6 dogs, 4 coho, and a sockeye. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
A dead whale found floating near Sitka last week was probably killed by a ship. That's the conclusion of a pathologist who inspected the carcass. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld explains.
The humpback whale was spotted floating in Sitka Sound September 13th. A team from the Sitka Tribe of Alaska and the University of Alaska Southeast arrived last weekend to check out the carcass, which was beached. Kathy Burek of Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services says the whale was a subadult, about 42 feet long. It had been dead for about a week.
It had indications of hemorrhage, would have been struck and possibly carried by a ship. So there was areas of trauma that look convincing that it had a major, you know, blunt impact.
She says it was likely a large vessel, such as a tanker, cruise ship, or ferry. But she's not positive.
We can't quite say it definitively at this point because, well, first of all, we only had a certain time to access the animal because of the tide, but also because there had been a lot of changes because the animal had, you know, rotted for a while.
The team cut into the whale, removing blubber and other tissue for further study. Burek says they climbed into the carcass for the difficult task of finding and removing its earplugs.
These plugs are formed by yearly laying down of earwax, basically. And then since a whale doesn't have a big, you know, opening out from the ear, it just tends to accumulate. And so if you can get that, there are ways to count those rings and to be able to be more definitive about how old the animal was.
Other samples will be used to determine whether the whale had been exposed to toxic algae blooms. Those have become more common as climate change has warmed the Pacific. Burek says the scientists are also interested in discovering what the whale had been eating. In a southern Baranof Island whale death earlier this summer, the animal turned out to be malnourished.
We didn't actually figure out a cause of death at all on that one. But its body condition did not look optimal, so that's another reason why we're doing those studies on nutrition.
The most recent whale carcass was left tied up on the beach. Burek calls it a present for the bears, but she also hopes follow-up examination will reveal more information about its injuries. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Sitka.
And if you'd like to know what it looks like to crawl inside a whale, we've got photos posted on our website, kfsk.org. This wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.